Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
Although it shook me too, because it means that those writings have a firmer root in his biography than I understood when I started working on Oscar Wilde. I was very caught up in the enchantment and the magic and the virtuosity. And I too was one of those readers or critics who saw these as consummate expressions of art. But I think that's right. From a biographical point of view, there is a kind of unity there. I think Wilde says at one point, all one's life, one is what one is going to be. And I think that's exactly it, that early periods of his life and the early works of his life are expressions of himself, of a self that is present right until the end.
I have had great success. I have had great failure. I have learned the value of each, and I know now that failure means more, always must mean more than success. Why then should I complain? I have at last come to the complete life which every artist must experience in order to join beauty to truth. The words of Oscar Wilde, taken from a conversation with English playwright and illustrator Lawrence Houseman in September 1899. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to explore the final years of Oscar Wilde's life with British literary critic and author Nicholas Frankel, whose latest biography, Oscar Wilde, The Unrepentant Years, has just been published by Harvard University Press, where Nick argues imprisonment and exile paradoxically liberated him to pursue an uninhibited life. So, who was Oscar Wilde? How uncompromising and resolute was he? And how did Wilde's experience of pain and suffering in Reading Gaol heighten his creative and imaginative powers?
A pleasure to be here. I'm Nicholas Frankel. I'm Professor of English at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. I've had a lifelong interest in Oscar Wilde. I've published a number of books on him, and this month marks the appearance of my latest book, a new biography, Oscar Wilde, The Unrepentant Years, focused on the neglected last years of his life, and I've edited a number of his works at this point too.
Really well done on the book, Nick. It's an extraordinary, interesting read. And I might pick up on the title later, The Unrepentant Years, because it is an angle that you do develop throughout the biography. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. What makes for a good life?
Well, it's a great question to ask a biographer, of course, a question I feel I'm probably better able to answer now than I was a few years ago. Wilde himself said that he had led a full, towards the very end of his life, he said he'd led a full or complete life, that he had experienced great success and great failure and had learned the value of each, that he'd experienced the bitter and the sweet, and he knew them both, and you needed to know them both to appreciate life to the full. But I think what strikes an outsider about Wilde's life is how completely he lived at one with himself, and how true he remained right up to the end of his days, really, right up to his death. And even in the face of adversity, he was perfectly and absolutely himself. And I think a couple of other things strike me about his life, too. He had an incredible capacity to take pleasure in life, even, as I say, in the face of extreme adversity. I suppose he treated life as a kind of gift. He would have said that life is the greatest of the arts. And I think when you look at his life, you see that idea reflected in his life as well as exemplified by it. He treats every day as a work of art. It's a well-lived life.
I suppose you could argue there that it's a very generous take on the world to treat every day as a work of art, because within all of that, it's leaving your life open to experimentation, to the spontaneous, to have a very fluid existence. And that in itself creates for an interesting life, doesn't it?
I think so. I think that's right. He's open to experience wherever it presents itself. I mean, there are some downsides too. He's not somebody who's careful at managing his life in the long term. He's terrible with money, for instance, and money sort of slipped through his fingers like water towards the end of his days. At the same time, he didn't really, I think this is what's new about my work, he didn't really harbor any bitterness about what had been done to him, and was nearly up until the end capable of living with extreme pleasure, really quite shocking pleasure and enjoyment of life.
He comes across as a very defined character in your biography, and that, you know, whether he was unrepentant or not, he was well able to put a confident face out to the world and to move forward in life.
I think that's right. Certainly that note of defiance was not always evident up until his imprisonment and his courtroom trials. I think, you know, to many in his day, he seemed a kind of court jester to the English, willing to play the dandy and the fool. But I think if you look a little bit more closely at his life, and most certainly at his work, I think you can see a real measure of defiance and even radical politics present in his work. And then, of course, that defiance becomes more open as a result of his trials and imprisonment when he comes out. At first, he's really quite radically defiant. He says he wants to emerge from prison, determined to change it, change prison for others, to represent the suffering in his writing. And he's really quite focused on the direction he wants to take, and really at odds with, always at odds with English culture, the English authoritarian culture.
Do you think his style of individualism was just too far ahead from his contemporaries? He obviously faced serious judgments later in life, and we might get on to that later. But he was clearly an individualist from an early age. But I'm wondering, was the world ready for that? You know, we live in very progressive times now, and we've a space for what people would see as maybe eccentricity or difference or whatever. But it seems from how you've written this biography that the world was not in step with him, or he maybe was not in step with that, or the world he was operating in. Maybe he was just a pace ahead, maybe.
I think that's exactly right, Susan. I think in some ways he's a more modern figure than the Victorians were able to handle. And he has much more, of course, much more in common, I think, with the 20th century than he does with the Victorian era. Of course, he was somebody who exploited the mass media and was careful to, I suppose he's one of the first modern celebrities, of course, early on in his career. And that's striking, his capacity to harness and use the media of his day. But I think, particularly in terms of sexuality and gender politics, he was really too hot to handle for the Victorians, pushing the limits of what it meant to be a man. And then, of course, hinting in his pre-prison writings, especially in The Picture of Dorian Gray, same-sex sexuality, male same-sex desire, and that was clearly too much for the institutions of his day. I can't help feeling it seeped over into his courtroom trials and partly explains the vehemence with which the English prosecuted him in 1895. It's reputed to be the case that he was given a number of opportunities to back out of those trials or to flee, to escape justice, but he wanted to hold his ground.
Do you think he was somewhat misunderstood by all of those around him? Because, you know, he's, you know, I can remember growing up and picking up some of his plays and, you know, talking to teachers at school and then talking to other people. And he's always seen as this kind of social butterfly, clearly great fun and, you know, but prancing around a bit and, you know, acting the bit of the twat. But underneath all that twat-like stuff, there was a very heavy, complex mind, which was had lots of ideas, lots of opinions, and clearly was ahead of his time. Like his ideas on prison conditions, his ideas on socialism and so on are very different to how he's framed as this velvet-wearing, jokey, larger-than-life, guy.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think one has to think of him really as speaking to at least two distinct audiences, and certainly to the popular, at the popular level, to a mass audience, he is what you're describing. He was something of a fool, something of a comical figure. It was hard to take him seriously. But I think those who knew him well, those perhaps of the same sexual persuasion or some political persuasions, took him far more seriously than that. I mean, for instance, George Bernard Shaw, the anarchist Prince Kropotkin, they understood where he was coming from. He had serious friends doing serious work. And of course, he was much more admired in France. The intellectual class did take him seriously in France, almost to the point, I think, of seeing him as one of their own. I think that partly helps to explain why he flew to France immediately after he came out of prison and seemed happy to remain there to the end of his days.
He must have been a very challenging person to write about, because clearly he challenges every idea on, you know, how to live a life, because he cross-cut so many different movements, creative pursuits, and also different types of social agendas. And he doesn't fit comfortably or neatly into any box. You know, it's easy just to say he was this, or it's easy to say he was that. But he was so many different things within his time to so many different people, and is also understood a lot differently now.
I think that's true, but it's also rather liberating, because he, as I began by saying, I think he's so much his own person. And you're right, there are so many elements to his makeup, and he is, there are so many elements to his makeup, but he's so much his own person. He's such a striking individual, and he's so distinctive in his language and in his wit. I personally found him thrill, pleasure to write about, and easy to write about. But you're right, he can't be pigeonholed. It would be wrong to pigeonhole him as a socialist or an Irish nationalist or even a homosexual spokesperson. Those are simplistic categories, and he defies that kind of simplification for sure.
Now, The Unrepentant Years focuses on the last few years of his life. And as I was progressing through the biography, I thought to myself, it's very sad reading about, you know, how some of his friendships dissolved. It was very sad reading about the how he was marginalised and how he was judged. But in another way, it's a very inspirational biography, because it's a story of resilience.
Absolutely. I think that's the most striking thing for me, is that so many people fell away, even people who had been close to him, friendly to him, sympathetic to him at earlier periods of his life, started to fall away. He remained resilient, and he remained even ebullient. Of course, he had a small circle that remained loyal to him, who he continued to see in his final years. And of course, the most significant of those is Lord Alfred Douglas, who I feel has been grossly misunderstood by history. And for at least a year, Douglas was very, very closely involved in Wilde's life. But Douglas is by no means the only one. But as I say, he maintained that ebullience, and he maintained his good humor. He could see the laughter. He remained capable of laughing at life right up to the end, really, right up until he began to get terminally sick in 1900, the year he died in.
How do you think he managed that, though, to stay positive, to stay creative and alive and receptive in the world? Because, you write that he lost his position in life, he lost his wife, his children, his wealth, his fame, a lot of his, you know, the social apparatus that he engaged with. He lost everything effectively, but he didn't lose his marbles.
That's true. You know, I think in a strange way, he was liberated by prison and by ostracism. It meant that he had really nothing more to lose. And I think in a sense, that liberated him to be more open about who he was. I think he became more uninhibited in these final years. In fact, it shocked the French. He was quite open about his relations with young men. I think even on the street, he was seen kissing or embracing young men, and he took young men back to his hotel room quite openly. And of course, this was very shocking in his day. It would even be shocking perhaps today. And he'd never been quite that open in London. Of course, he'd been married and had to maintain the facade of the husband, father, and paterfamilias, but he could drop all that when he came out of prison. So I do feel, in a strange way, he was liberated by it.
You write, Wilde always insisted his writing should be understood as consummate examples of art for art's sake. I'm just wondering what you make of that.
Well, to some extent, that has always been the position. He insisted on a number of occasions that he was the consummate artist. And of course, early in his career, he was in competition with people like James McNeill Whistler, the supreme aesthete, another remarkable dandy, incidentally. And I think for large parts of the last 100 years, it has been the case that critics have seen his writings as art for art's sake, whatever his views and his positions might have been. This is writing that is remarkable for its wit, its dexterity, and its verbal beauty. But I can't help feeling that that was something of a mask and a deflection, and that he used the facade of the consummate artist as a kind of mask behind which he was operating. And of course, I suppose at a deeper level, his writings are concerned with social and sexual values, and he's trying to change those values too.
You mentioned Richard Ellman and his iconic biography of Oscar Wilde. You also touch on the fact that he presented his life somewhat like a Greek tragedy. And I'm just wondering, can you talk me through that?
Well, yes, Ellman shapes Oscar Wilde's life as a Greek tragedy. And I suppose, you know, the bulk of Ellman's concern, the bulk of that biography, and it's a marvelous biography up to a point, is concerned with the years of success, with the large part of Wilde's life that took place before his imprisonment. That means that Ellman, and to be fair to Ellman, he was terminally ill when he was in a rush to finish that biography. He didn't really give that much attention to Wilde's life after he came out of prison. And so it was very easy to see Wilde's final years as a kind of tragic end to years of great success. But of course, what I've done is largely ignore those years of success, so-called success, and of course they were successful in many ways, and really try to comprehend this final period on its own terms and look at Wilde very closely for how he behaved and what he said and his relationships in these final years. And I've come to a very different set of conclusions, that his life, you know, shouldn't be shaped as a tragedy. He wasn't a victim. He certainly wasn't the victim of Lord Alfred Douglas, as Richard Ellman makes him out to be. He was somebody, he was deeply in love with Lord Alfred Douglas, and I believe Douglas was deeply in love with him too. And that explains a lot of their behaviors in the last year. But he was somebody, as I began by saying, who maintained a capacity to enjoy and celebrate life, even in the face of poverty and social ostracism.
But Nick, it all comes down to the, you know, philosophical questions of, like, how do you view success? How do you view wealth? How do
yes.
you view ambition? And whether you could see ambition in terms of how it relates to resilience and survival, or how you overcome suffering and pain and all of that type of stuff. Or you could look at crudely as in the houses that you live in, you know, the successful, you know, books that you publish and the money you make out of it. So what
yes.
one biographer will pick up on is very different to another.
Yes, I think so. Although even those years of so-called success, you know, just success by the common standards of our day, you know, monetary, social success, career success, Wilde was always flirting with disaster, it has to be remembered. He called himself the spendthrift of his own genius. I think he knew that he was always on the verge of disaster. Of course, his finances were a wreck, and his in the same year in which he was imprisoned, of course, he was declared bankrupt. And he wasn't made bankrupt simply because of the legal costs that he was forced to pay during his trials. He was made bankrupt too because of the incredible expenditures he'd made over those years. So again, I think there's more consistency between these so-called years of disaster and so-called years of success than Ellman would have made out. You know, that he was always living on the brink.
I found your chapter on Wilde's experience in prison very, very moving. You know, he slept on a plank bed. There was no comforts whatsoever. And you describe the treadmill, and it is horrific to think how prisoners were, how they were either put into solitary confinement, the food rationing, and how they were treated. Like in today's world of international human rights law and humane values and treating people with respect and dignity, it is quite something to think anyone could survive that system. Can you describe what Wilde actually went through?
Well, you're right. It's a shocking and soul-destroying system of punishment that he was put through. And I think it's been described as verging on torture, the severest system of punishment in English history. And at the time that Wilde was put in prison, most prisoners were, as well as given a sentence of time in prison, they were subjected to what the late Victorians called hard labor. They were made to perform meaningless, arduous task that had absolutely no productive purpose whatsoever. So walking the treadmill for hours on end per day, or turning a very stiff crank in their prison cell, again, for hours a day. I mean, if I can just give you the statistics, I think the Department of Prisons mandated that prisoners on the treadmill had to climb 8,000 feet on the treadmill per day. I mean, that's like climbing a mountain.
You know, when you think about it, it is literally hiking for several hours.
It's hiking for several hours. And this is a man who was not in good health. And it wasn't any great surprise that within a matter of days, he turned seriously ill in prison. So he was actually only set to the treadmill, I believe, for a couple of weeks, because he went to the infirmary straight after that. And of course, that event became publicized. Journalists got to know about it, and he became something of a poster boy for the abuses of the prison system. But thereafter, he was assigned to so-called second-class labor. The treadmill was so-called first-class hard labor. Second-class hard labor was usually the assignment of picking oakum, separating the strands of old tarry rope in his cell. And he did this in his cell for hours on end, right up until the end of his imprisonment, in fact, until at least over halfway through his imprisonment. And in fact, one of his visitors remarked when he had very few visitors, because the rules only allowed four prison visits a year. But one of his visitors attested that his fingers were bleeding and chapped from picking oakum. So there was that physical torture element to his sentence. Of course, he was in solitary confinement, again, as part of the prison system, they justified it as maintaining that, insisting that prisoners be kept apart from one another in absolute silence and separation. They called it the separate system. This period of British imprisonment from about 1875, 1877, right up to the year after he came out of jail, 1898, when the prison there was a new prisons bill that reformed the system. This was probably the most severe period of British of punishment in British prisons in history, I believe. It's his imprisonment that especially publicized the shocking horror of that system. And of course, when he came out of prison, he published a number of pieces, most notably the Ballad of Reading Gaol, that gave flesh. And allowed readers to experience how cruel and how terrible the system was for themselves. So that poem had some effect on the public debate, and I think contributed to that political change in the prison system.
Yeah, you describe very vividly, you know, that he suffered incessant diarrhea, continual bouts of insomnia. But it is interesting to see how one life and how one creative life can, in, you know, whether it can improve the situation or people's situation in other worlds, in other lives. Because he clearly improved the prison system, which impacted on how prisoners were treated with dignity and respect in Ireland. Like that in itself itself is very inspirational. I'm just wondering, how would you describe his brand of socialism? Because it's socialism with a certain ching to it, isn't it?
That's right, that's right. And people have questioned whether he is a genuine socialist. Of course, he published a remarkable essay 4 years before he went to prison called The Soul of Man Under Socialism. And I think that still was a thorn in the side of the English at the time of his imprisonment, where he really does take aim at the English class system and at a materialist culture. But you're right. I mean, it's not certainly not orthodox socialism. I would describe his politics as really the politics of the individual. He believes very firmly in the rights of the individual, the freedoms of the individual, the freedoms to love who we want, the freedoms to speak and say what we want. And he's an enemy of any kind of coercive authoritarianism. I think he would frankly class himself as a supreme individualist, but in his hands that becomes a kind of political principle.
He was a very forgiving character when you think about it. Now, obviously, you know, he was running against the times and came up against a lot of moral, social, economic and, I suppose, political obstacles. But in terms of the space he gave to Lord Alfred Douglas, I think in a lot of ways it's very admirable. Because whether he was willing to give it a second go, a third go, and, you know, yeah. Dirty stuff happens in all relationships. There's never a good guy and a bad guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
Everybody acts up. It's too, you know what I mean? We've all done it. But yeah. I'm just wondering, he had a remarkable capacity for forgiveness. And he had the, I suppose, enthusiasm for life to give things another go.
That's right. Well, of course, he says at one point of his love for Lord Alfred Douglas, he says this to another friend, I love him because he ruined my life.
And he the greatest loves do that. They tend to, don't they?
So he knew that the power, he knew of the power that Douglas held over his life, the spell that Douglas cast. But to be honest, I think he never really fell out of love with Lord Alfred Douglas. And I think we need to give Douglas more credit than he's been given in the past for loving Oscar Wilde, and actually in his way staying truer to him than many commentators have described in the past. I don't think he had quite so much to forgive as he is reputed to have had. Of course, he's very hostile to Douglas in that long letter that he writes in prison that's now known as De Profundis. It's really a kind of autobiography, one of Wilde's greatest works. And I spent about a chapter or part of a chapter of my book describing that letter. And in the course of that letter, Wilde really takes Douglas to task for being the reason for his own downfall and imprisonment. But I think it's now generally regarded by scholars and people who've looked at their lives closely that a lot of those charges are unfair and in some cases actually just quite untrue.
And possibly a bit simplistic as well, because clearly there was great passion between them and great energy
yes.
and chemistry. But within
yes.
all of that, and we all know, you know, in terms when we experience these great highs in sexual relationships, that you can have absolute contempt and absolute drive for a person simultaneously. It's
yes.
it's what happens in the dizziness of sexual charge, I suppose.
That's right. Well, yes, and emotional, and in fact, you know, literary sympathy as well. Douglas was a poet, and I think there's a lot more in common between them than is regarded generally seen as being the case. He really loved Douglas's writing, and of course, Douglas when he reconciled with Douglas after coming out of prison, Douglas was present for large parts of the time when Wilde was writing the Ballad of Reading Gaol. In fact, A.E. Housman thought that Douglas had a hand in the composition of the poem, but as I say, I think they were they remained, you know, that's the full gamut, the full range of emotions in their relationship. It's truly a rich and interesting relationship. Of course, the danger is that Wilde felt that he needed to run Douglas down to others, and he would do this in writing, and of course, he did this in De Profundis, and those writings have survived. And so people tend to take Wilde at his word when he's running Douglas down to to others who aren't Douglas. But he did that for rather strategic reasons. And even De Profundis was a document written in prison, seen by the prison authorities. Every day it would be looked over by the prison governor. So I can't help feeling that Wilde knew this and was really writing partly for an audience of the prison authorities.
I loved reading about his friendship with Robbie Ross. He was his former lover, and you write beautifully how they're now buried together. Robbie Ross financially bankrolled Oscar Wilde. He was a great support mentally and emotionally to him. And he was a great, I suppose, mentor in ways. Can you talk to me about how he went about getting buried with Oscar Wilde? Because it's a beautiful passage. You talk about when his body was taken out of the grave, that he held him in his arms and everything. It's so beautiful and dramatic and all the rest.
I'm glad you found that passage moving. I did too. I think Ross did feel this incredible loyalty and responsibility for Wilde. While Wilde was alive, he knew that Wilde was a spendthrift, that he couldn't manage money, he couldn't really organize his daily affairs. So Ross really managed, I suppose one would say he was Wilde's financial manager, and would manage the allowance, in fact, that Wilde's wife granted Wilde, and after her death that came from her estate. But once Wilde had died, and of course in the last month, Ross was present during Wilde's final sickness and was one of just the two individuals present on the day of Wilde's death. So we have that incredible witness description of Wilde's death that comes from the pen of Robert Ross. But once Wilde had died, Ross really spent the rest of his life dedicated to restoring Wilde's reputation, to trying to put the estate back on a solid financial footing, restoring Wilde's copyrights, getting Wilde out of bankruptcy, and also taking some responsibility for Wilde's children, who, of course, were orphans by this point. Both their mother and father were dead. And Ross really took the children under his wing and tried to get them to feel connected to their father and to their father's friends.
And as you write, I think Constance's, Oscar Wilde's wife, had died a few months before, hadn't she?
She had died in 1898, again, very, very young. She died of what's now surmised to have been complications from multiple sclerosis. It wasn't diagnosed in her own time, so she let surgeons, an Italian surgeon, operate on her when she probably shouldn't have done, because there was nothing to be done surgically, and she died of complications from the surgery. This is about just over 2 years before Wilde died, and the children weren't present at the funerals of either of their parents, and weren't indeed even informed of their father's death. Their guardians didn't even let them know their father was alive.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with British literary critic and author Dr. Nicholas Frankel, whose latest book, Oscar Wilde, The Unrepentant Years, has just been published by Harvard University Press. I asked Nick about his decision to publish a photograph of Oscar Wilde laid out on his deathbed in Paris in 1900. And I put it to him. I was a little surprised by that.
Well, there's an interesting story behind that photograph. And of course, I think it's an important photograph because, he's dressed in he's dressed immaculately with the rosary on him. So it does reinforce the piece that he might have found at the end after days of really, really horrible physical suffering from the meningoencephalitis that killed him. But it's the story behind that photograph that I find especially interesting. That photograph is reputed to have been taken by one of Wilde's lovers, a young man of the name of Morris Gilbert, who Wilde befriended and became close to shortly after moving to Paris in early 1898. And Gilbert remained good friends with him right up to the end and was present throughout the final period of his final illness. And Robert Ross asked Gilbert to take that photograph after he'd been laid out. But the other thing that's interesting to me about that photograph is I think it's taken with Oscar Wilde's own camera. It's known that Wilde had bought a camera and had taken up photography in the last year of his life. And again, this is another instance of how he was determined to get the most out of life. When he's on holiday in Italy about 9 months before he dies, he's photographing cows in the Borgia Gardens in Rome and really enjoying. He says he should have taken up photography as a career. And so that's really the story behind that photograph. It's taken with Wilde's own camera, I believe, by one of his close lovers.
Yeah, it's funny. I was reading your biography late into the evening, and it's all, I suppose, how you look at photographs and what time of day and everything. But I found myself staring and staring and staring at the dead Oscar Wilde. And I just thought to myself, I was just one major weirdo. But it is something, there is something curious and remarkable looking at these figures from history, whether it's politics, literature, culture, arts, whatever it is. And, you know, we have ideas in our head when they're so full of life. So, and Oscar Wilde was such a lively and spontaneous soul. It's very hard to see him just flat there in the bed.
I think that's exactly it, Stu. That's exactly how I feel, that he's he's so much larger than life, and he's so full of life. As you say, to see him laid out there at the end of his life, after his life, it's really quite shocking. This, as you say, in those other photographs of him in my biography, and of course there's lots and lots of photographs of out there, he looms large, doesn't he? His intensity, his energy just leaps off the page. But there, as you say, it's shocking to see that he's lost it finally.
Do you think he got peace at the end? Like, clearly he was one of our world's great survivors, and he was very resilient and proactive and creative in how he dealt with adversity. The picture of him lying out, he looks, he looks quite at peace. But, you know, and I was surprised to see the cross on him and so on. But I'm wondering about his religious makeup or his spiritual makeup or whatever. Do you think that gave him some comfort of some sort at the end? Because he was in excruciating pain.
He was in excruciating pain. And I think, in the last weeks of his life, just physically, he was in excruciating unrelievable pain, and the suffering must have been immense, and it seemed like the opiates and the drugs didn't really touch it, and of course his last hours were terrible. There is some debate as to whether he truly had turned to Catholicism in the last hours of his life. There's some debate as to whether he was actually conscious when he wasn't given the Eucharist, because he couldn't take the wafer. But the last rites, some of the last rites were given to him, and he's reputed to have converted to Catholicism on his deathbed. But there is some debate about that, because, of course, he wasn't terribly conscious, and he didn't really have his faculties. It may have been those around him who were determined to have him brought into the Catholic Church in those final hours. What's interesting, though, is that when he's in Rome about 6 months before his death, before he gets really seriously sick, he's really toying with Catholicism. He goes to have audiences with the Pope, but he does it all in a sense with a sense of irony and humor, and he loves the thought that he's being blessed, having a personal audience, a personal blessing from the Pope, when, of course, he's been in prison for sex crimes for 2 years. He gets a kind of kick out of that. And I think he says at one point, "I'm not a Catholic. I detest Catholics. I'm just a violent papist." He loves the theater of Catholicism, but I don't know how deep it really goes. But in terms of peace, I think one has to say, well, of course, there is that quote that I begin my biography with when he says, "I have at last come to the complete life which every artist must experience to in order to join beauty to truth." So certainly about a year before his death, he does seem to have reconciled himself to what life had thrown at him and to have achieved a sense of oneness, and I think one could say peace. But as I say, this physical illness that killed him, I think physically one has to say he was in suffering when he died.
It's a very courageous way to look at the world, to join beauty to truth, because, you know, you have to live within the darkness and the light.
That's
so
exactly right.
I just wondered that maybe he was operating on some, like, he clearly was socializing with people from all over the world, from all different backgrounds. It struck me that his spiritual makeup of sorts was something a little bit more progressive than the traditional.
Yes, yes. He's very much a creature of this world. I think he says at one point, "I'm a man for whom the visible world exists." And of course, he's implying that what is not present to the senses and that what one cannot experience for oneself directly doesn't really mean that much to him. But he calls it the mystery of the visible world. I think that's right. He's so much a creature of the world. He enjoys the world. He's able to live in the world. He's a creature of the world.
But when you think about it, Nick, you know, as you state in the biography, he came out of prison as, you know, the most famous sex offender from Britain. And, you know, that was within the eyes of Victorian law. Now, thankfully, we have moved on and evolved as societies. And, you know, Oscar Wilde would never have been in the position today that he was in.
Yes.
But he had quite a label to live with. You know, he was fundamentally tarnished.
Yes, that's right. But I think he was fully aware of the injustice, as we would now see it, of his prosecution, and as he saw it too. He was, as I would insist, unapologetic and unrepentant for the supposed crimes that had put him in prison. And as you say, many of them would not be crimes today. So this goes back to your earlier point that he's really a creature ahead of his time. He knew that the problem was the law, and the law needed to be changed. I think he was determined to do what he could to change the law.
Just wondering, Nick, have you passed the book over to his grandson?
Well, Merlin Holland, the Wilde's grandson, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to him with a number of my books. He's always been helpful and very supportive for me. So I haven't actually received my author's copies yet, but I'm hoping to send him a copy in the next couple of weeks once I get my own copies.
I'm sure you'll find it very interesting to see what he'll pick up upon, because you described yourself as an outsider at the start of the interview on his life. And clearly you weren't around in Wilde's time and are not a family friend. But
yes,
by being the biographer and by focusing in on such a critical and transformative stage in his life, you become very intimate with your subject.
I think that's right. And I hope that Wilde's grandson, Merlin, appreciates that I'm able, my lack of a personal stake, you know, my outsider status gives me a kind of objectivity that maybe some others don't have. I don't think I came to this book with an agenda, for instance. As I say, not even with a really personal stake. I came to it as a literary historian and biographer, and I hope that Merlin Holland, that gives it extra value in Merlin Holland's eyes.
Has it made you look at Oscar Wilde's art in any way differently? Like how the questions you would ask yourself as you sit through one of his plays, whether it's Salome or An Ideal Husband or whatever it is, or how you view one of, you know, let's say The Portrait of Dorian Gray. Has it made you look at some of the scenarios or questions that Wilde asked in some of his literature? Has it made you look at the questions a bit differently or given you a different take on them in some way?
That's a great question, and in some ways that's the big question, isn't it? And the short answer is yes. It's made me see those writings from before prison, his most popular writings from before in prison, especially the plays, in a different light. I see more consistency now than I did previously between the spectacular writings, the plays, the fictions, the poems that he wrote before prison, and the Ballad of Reading Gaol and De Profundis. I see more of that defiance and more of that hostility to English Puritanism and English authoritarianism. I see that present in the earlier works much more than I used to, I think.
And you find that consoling? As a biographer, because clearly you're a fan, you've, you know, published widely on Oscar Wilde's life and works. So by being able to join up the dots and see the synergies and seeing the, you know, the interrelatedness of his output, that must be very comforting.
Although it shook me too, because it means that those writings have a firmer root in his biography than I understood when I started working on Oscar Wilde. I was very caught up in the enchantment and the magic and the virtuosity. And I too was one of those readers or critics who saw these as consummate expressions of art. But I think that's right. From a biographical point of view, there is a kind of unity there. I think Wilde says at one point, all one's life, one is what one is going to be. And I think that's exactly it, that the early periods of his life and the early works of his life are expressions of himself, of a self that is present right until the end.
You end the book on a very inspirational note, Nick. You argue Wilde's greatest achievement in exile was himself. I thought that was remarkable. It was very interesting.
Well, thank you. Yes, I mean, I think it's that freedom to be himself. And of course, the tragic side of that is that he is no longer willing or able to produce literature in the way that he was before he went to prison. I mean, is that there are these last two great works, the prison works, De Profundis and The Ballad of Reading Gaol. But after the publication of The Ballad of Reading Gaol and his publication of the two of the plays that he'd written earlier, there's really not much more literary output. So from a literary standpoint, you know, I'm a teacher of literature. I lament that he wasn't able to produce more writing. Of course, he'd lost his audience. That's, you know, he had nobody who would read that kind of work, and maybe he wasn't even able to produce that kind of work anymore. But I think that freed him up, as I say, to put his creativity into his conversation, into his letters, and he clearly had a crowd in Paris who would hang on his every word, and he delighted in entertaining them to the full. So, yes, I think he put his genius into his life.
And lastly, and if it's not a bit too simplistic, is there a lesson in all of this? Because that was a question I was asking myself when I finally put your book to bed. That, you know, is there a lesson in this life? It was a courageous life. It was a radical type of life in a lot of different ways. And it was a very creative life. But if we can learn a lesson or glean some insights into life from Oscar Wilde's life and how he lived it, what would it be?
Well, I think two lessons that I see: to remain true to yourself and to remain firm in your belief in yourself in the face of extreme opposition and hostility. He was certainly capable of that. And also his determination to treat life as a gift, to enjoy what new things each day offered him, which was a very spontaneous life, of course. And it must have been a difficult life for those who were close to him and who lived with him, because he was so spontaneous. But he had a tremendous ability to enjoy life and to laugh at life.
That was British literary critic and author Dr. Nicholas Frankel. Oscar Wilde, The Unrepentant Years is published by Harvard University Press and retails for in around €28 in paperback. Now, I have to say, hats off to Nick. This is a very spacious and beautifully written read. I absolutely loved it. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Niamh McGee, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the perceptive words of playwright, poet and essayist Oscar Wilde, who once quipped, "The truth is never pure and rarely simple." How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.